Very good evening, folks. Thank you again to Charmaine and other members of the staff team for the invitation to join you this day for your workplace Sunday. And thanks very much to you as a church for your welcome of me. It's been lovely to be with you this morning and now this evening too. Let me repeat what I said this morning, which is that I bring with me the greetings from the LICC team and also the gratitude of the long links that we have as an organization with you as a church, extending back now 35 years when John Stott first founded LICC. I'm very grateful for all the support from All Souls during that time. It is your workplace Sunday as a church, and we're exploring wisdom at work. And for it, I wanted us to look at two of the Bible's wisdom books. Proverbs this morning, we're in chapter 31, the last chapter of that book, and Ecclesiastes this evening. And I hope that that would allow us to reflect together on the good of work, which we did this morning, and the gift of work, which we'll do this evening. I have given the title Laughing in the... Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. I gave the title Laughing in the Vineyard this morning and this evening Singing at the Wine Press. And I hope the reasons for that will become clear at the end. Perhaps you're one of those people who bounces out of bed first thing in the morning with a lightness in your step and a song on your lips. Your morning routine is purposeful but relaxed. You smile at fellow passengers on the commute. Yeah? You breeze into work, cheerily greeting your colleagues, looking forward to all that the day holds. Perhaps. If so, the rest of us are really pleased for you. Although we secretly wonder whether you're in deep denial or whether you're taking something that may or may not be available over the pharmacy counter. For many of us, the reality is work can be a drag. Not all the time, of course, but with enough periods of frustration and futility and sheer hard graft to make us wonder about escaping to a much simpler life without jammed photocopiers and rude customers and demanding managers and unrealistic deadlines. And that's just LICC. If God created work, we should expect it to be fulfilling, shouldn't we? If only we had a wise person to steer us through this dilemma. Well, I want to suggest to you that we do. We do in Ecclesiastes. Not that the book is always easy to understand. Reading Ecclesiastes, I've come to see, is a little bit like staring at one of those optical illusion drawings. You know the kind of thing? You look at the drawing one way and you see a double profile. You look at it another way and you see a vase. You look at Ecclesiastes one way and you see hearty hope. You look at Ecclesiastes another way and you see deathly despair. And just, if you've ever read the book, you might have had this experience. Just when you feel you've got a grasp on what's going on in the book, it says something which turns what you thought back on its head. Ecclesiastes just isn't what we expect of the Bible. It doesn't sound always very, well, biblical, if we're honest. And yet, the same God who inspired the Gospels and the letters and the Psalms and the Proverbs, that same God speaks here too. And His Word is profitable to us. And the one God speaks through here is called the Teacher. In chapter 1, verse 1, we read the words of the Teacher, Son of David, King of Jerusalem. So even if this is Solomon writing, he does so under the guise of the voice of this teacher. And as we read Ecclesiastes, we get the sense that it's an older voice. It's the voice of someone who's been around the block a few times. It's a voice which has seen the many exceptions to the way that life is meant to work. This is the teacher. And what's the teacher's message? Well, chapter 1, verse 2 tells us, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That word that's translated there in the NIV is meaningless occurs 38 times in the book. It conjures up the idea of vapor or breath. And it describes how life is temporary, or fleeting, an enigma, a paradox, if you like. Life seems to take one shape, and then before you know it, it takes another shape. And it looks solid, but you try to grab hold of it, and it slips through your fingers. And when you're stuck in the thick of it, like fog, it's impossible to see clearly. It's like chasing after the wind, to use another phrase of the teacher's. And it's not so far into the book that the teacher is talking about work. Chapter 1, verse 3. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? And he addresses the topic of work at several points in this book, including in the passage that we've got open before us this evening. In fact, we will find, I hope, that Ecclesiastes does help us with the question, what are we working for? What are you working for? How does our culture tell us what we're working for? What are some of the drivers in culture when it comes to work? Well, one prominent one is working for a lifestyle. This is probably the most dominant driver in our culture. Work is a necessary evil. It provides the resources for leisure. It's about working for the weekend. Work is how you get the stuff you want to live your life. In a survey a few years back of about 30,000 workers worldwide, 28 to 50% wanted to leave their jobs. And the second highest reason was something called work-life balance. Work-life balance, what a strange phrase. What does it assume? It assumes that you can't have a life at work. That work is not part of life. It assumes that work, providing you get the balance right, exists to make life possible. I do this stuff over here in order to be able to do this stuff over here. A friend of mine in his 30s living in London observes that young couples, as he sees it, young couples in London are on what he describes as a conveyor belt. And the conveyor belt begins, he says, around Clapham, or Battersea for the edgier ones. And then they start having families, so they move a little bit further out on the conveyor belt. And then some years later, a little bit further out, even closer to heaven on earth, also known as Surrey. And often both parents are working incredibly hard to make this dream happen. And of course, often there are good desires here. There's a longing for home and for family and for community and for good schools for the kids. And yet, it produces rootlessness. They're chasing something, but it's an endless pursuit. It's a little bit like this character. Do you know this character? Wile E. Coyote. In his endless chasing of Roadrunner. And if you know the cartoons, Wile E. Coyote never stops trying and uses more and more elaborate contraptions, but never manages to catch the Roadrunner. Although, actually, I'm told in some rare footage available on YouTube, he does catch the Roadrunner. You can have a look. He catches the roadrunner, he cooks the roadrunner, and he's eating the roadrunner with a friend in his dining room. And the friend says to him, so what are you going to do now? And Wile E. Coyote says, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. I'm not trained for anything else. Endless pursuit. Now, this actually is nothing new. As we see in Ecclesiastes, here is an author, and he's taking on the persona of this teacher, the wisest, richest, most gifted person alive. And in chapter 2, he gives us an example of what it means to work for a lifestyle. Luke didn't read it out to us, but let's have a little glance at the last part of verse 3 onwards in chapter 2. Chapter 2 and the last part of verse 3. The teacher says there, I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during a few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. And so the passage continues. You might know it. But then in verse 11 comes the roadrunner moment. Yet. When I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, vaporous, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. When he surveyed all that he'd managed to accomplish, the richest, wisest, most gifted teacher alive could say, you know what, it was all vaporous, chasing the wind. That's what working for a lifestyle can be like. But the second driver that's worth us thinking about is working for the work. Working for the work. Instead of work being the means to some future reward, some picture of the good life, working for the work is when work is an end in itself. You live to work. In the 1930s, John Maynard Keynes, one of the most significant economists, predicted a 15-hour working week by the end of the 20th century. There was such a profound belief in the 20th century that technological advancement, increasing means of production, meant that we'd all just be working on Tuesdays. Maybe a little bit of Wednesday morning. You might know in Disney Pixar's Wall-E, robots do everything. And their humans have become inert blobs lying on levitating sofas. Is that what we're looking forward to? What's the reality? Well, the reality is that in London, workers in full-time employment work an average of 38 hours a week. One in six Londoners work more than 48 hours a week. I wonder if you're one of them. Now, of course, we can understand, can't we, the extent to which work does give meaning to people's lives. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But, of course, that good thing can so easily be misdirected, pushed to an extreme where work becomes a source of ultimate identity. I think we see this driver in our society in the way that people introduce themselves, or we introduce ourselves. How do we introduce ourselves in a culture? After you give your name, 9 times out of 10, someone will say to you, and what do you do? And if something as simple as introducing yourself reveals a kind of subcurrent of our culture, why is that the first question that we always ask? Is work where our identity is primarily found? What are the implications of that? It's actually a default setting that tells us some very interesting things about ourselves and about our culture. And once again, it's not new. We see it in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, in the passage that Luke read to us. Verse 17 is a kind of bridge, really. It concludes the flow of thought from the previous paragraph, and it introduces the next paragraph. "So I hated light," the teacher says, "because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." And then he tells us that the thought of finding comfort in those who come after us is meaningless because there's no guarantee that they'll be wise or foolish. So look at verses 18 and 19. "I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. We have no real control, finally, over our legacy. What will happen? Who will remember us 100 years from now and what we did?" So how does that make the teacher feel? Well, he tells us in verse 20, "So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun." Working for the work doesn't cut it. Verse 21, "For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune." And aside from the future that he's looking to in those verses, in verses 22 and 23, he kind of comes back to the present. Even now, he says, apart from thinking about the future, even now work causes us pain and grief. Verse 22, "What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun?" And that repeats the thought of chapter 1, verse 3, in almost exactly the same words. He's coming back to where he started. And that very question, he says, causes sleepless nights. Verse 23, "All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This, too, is meaningless." Happy? Basically, summarizing verses 17 to 23, he says, you work your whole life and leave it to someone who didn't work for it, who may muck it up, on top of which all the effort you put in, including the sleepless nights, is nothing more than pain or grief. Now, at this point, you might well be wondering, why have we come to Ecclesiastes for a Christian approach to work? We might say, this is the word of the Lord, but it's perhaps not so easy, is it, to say, thanks be to God. Now, ideally, we would now spend some time processing this. Of those two drivers that we've spoken about, working for the lifestyle and working for the work, which do you see at play in your own workplace? Which do you see most influencing yourself, your colleagues? You might want to think about that. And is there an alternative to working for the lifestyle and working for the work? There is. And I think the teacher helps us here. It's seeing work as a gift. Work as a gift. Look at verses 24 to 26 for a moment. God has not been mentioned at all so far in chapter 2. But now he takes center stage. "A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth, to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This, too, is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Actually, this is the first of a number of passages in Ecclesiastes where the teacher says something like, a person can do nothing better than this. And there are a number of those passages, as I say. Let's just glance at the next two in chapter 3. If you want to flick over your Bible to chapter 3, verses 12 to 13, where the teacher says, "I know that there is nothing better," similar phrase, "for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil." What does he say? "This is the gift of God." And then a little bit further down in verse 22 of chapter 3, "So I saw that there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work, because that is their lot. For who can bring them to see what will happen after them?" And like I say, there are other similar references in Ecclesiastes, and they add up to say to us, essentially, find enjoyment in your daily existence, including work, as a gift from the hand of God. And these passages stand out in Ecclesiastes because they are positive. But importantly, they don't negate everything else. Verses 24 to 26 of chapter 2 don't negate what the teacher has said earlier on in chapter 2. It's not as if the teacher has broken through his pessimism and now come out the other side. He's taking us on a journey, and his message unfolds as the journey unfolds. And he's continually led to the conclusion that everything, including work, is meaningless, but that's placed side by side with these confessions about the goodness of life, including work, as a gift from God. And I want to suggest to us that wisdom in a fallen world involves navigating between those two poles. The reality of vaporousness and the gift of God. In his commentary on Ecclesiastes, Philip Ryken recalls a New Yorker cartoon in which a publisher is pleading with a novelist to change his opening line. "Mr. Dickens," he says, "either it was the best of times or it was the worst of times. It can't be both." But of course it can be both. And in life, even for Christians, it often is. You see, as it happens, we are created in the image of God, himself a worker, a God who finds satisfaction and delight in his work, and who designed work to be fulfilling, not frustrating, to be pleasurable, not painful. But of course, work, like all things, was impacted by human rebellion against God and alienation from each other. And so we are aware that there is something lost, something skewed at the heart of existence, something skewed deep in us. And we see that in every workplace. And we don't need to pretend as Christians that we don't experience that ourselves. We do. Our work brings with it a daily reminder that the world, the whole world, including us, remains out of kilter with God's design. Where it's possible to make too much of work or too little of work. Where it's possible to take work in a direction that it was never intended to go. Where it's possible to make work an ultimate rather than a penultimate. Where it's possible to turn work into a God thing rather than a good thing. What is work? The teacher tells us it's a gift. It's a gift from the hand of God. And I think the teacher would want us to get work in its proper place in God's design. To see the futility of asking work to satisfy us in ways that was never intended to do so, whether it's working for the lifestyle or working for the work, and he'd want us to see work as a gift from God himself. That doesn't devalue work. On the contrary, it liberates me to see my work rightly. I'm free to find enjoyment in my work as the gift of God, and not primarily for the lifestyle it brings, or even for the work itself. And here, let me say, we come back to where we ended this morning, with the whole of our lives, including our work, coming under the rule of Christ. We are, as Christians, first and foremost, followers of Jesus, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and everything falls into place behind that. Work is just one of the ways that I respond as a disciple of Christ to his calling on me to follow him, to love God, to love my neighbor, to bear fruit for the glory of God. My work is just one of the many places where I live out my larger, primary, more embracing call to follow Jesus and to serve others. And in that life of discipleship, work is given to us, thank God, as a gift. By God's grace, we know the full story when maybe the teacher didn't. We know that history is leading somewhere. We know that death is not the end. And yet, the era we now find ourselves in is also one in which creation groans. And we groan with creation. And so Ecclesiastes continues to be significant for us. It's significant for us pastorally as we talk about these things with one another. It's significant for us evangelistically, maybe, as we engage with our colleagues and friends and neighbors. They too struggle with the enigmas of life. We know that the goal of salvation is the restoration of our full humanity, when the world will be fully healed, fully restored, when we will finally be delivered from all futility. No more meaninglessness. And we seek to bear witness to that world now. Of course it's partial. Of course it's frustrating. Because we're not there yet. This side of the new heavens and the new earth, we're still not exempt from the vapor of life. But seeing work as a gift from the hand of a gracious God, we can be signposts to what will be. So meanwhile, we can capture something of God's gift to us, as the teacher says, of eating, of drinking, and finding satisfaction in our work. The joy of freshly baked bread, the joy of fine wine or rich coffee or freshly squeezed orange juice, the joy of a job well done. To see work as a gift from God, even in the mundane tasks, writing an email, placing an order, servicing a boiler, tightening a bolt, teaching a class. See, there is joy in Ecclesiastes, but it doesn't come from working for the lifestyle, and it doesn't come from working for the work. It comes from working in gratitude for the gift of God, despite the absurdities of life. On the question of whether Ecclesiastes is fundamentally pessimistic or optimistic, the 16th century reformer Martin Luther knew his own mind. It was positive. Indeed, our title this evening, Singing at the Wine Press, is taken from something that Luther wrote on Ecclesiastes. Indeed, he said, all our toil should be like that of those who, in the winepress or in the harvest, sing as they work. Wherever and whatever your winepress may be tomorrow and this week, may it be to you a gift from God, and may you sing to the glory of God. Amen.